morning. We're trying to begin it on time. Thank you very much for being here so early after the dinner. I'm going to introduce you to Stephen Downs, that is our first speaker this morning. Stephen is senior researcher for the National Research Council of Canada, based in Moncton, New Brunswick, since 2001. Stephen specializes in the field of online learning, new media, pedagogy, and philosophy. He's widely accepted as a central authority for online education in the EduBlogging community as an originator of the e-learning 2.0. He's probably best known for his daily newsletter, OL Daily, which is distributed by web, email, and RSS to thousands of subscribers around the world. He has published numerous articles, both online and in print, including The Future of Online Learning in 1998, Learning Objects 2000, Resource Profiles 2003, and e-learning 2.0 2005. Downs is, as he defines himself, a popular speaker, someone who intervenes a lot also in every event where he participates and around the world. And it's an honor to have him with us today. He will talk to us about the role of open educational resources in personal learning. So we are here to hear from you.
Okay, well, thank you. Like yesterday, right, I have to do that. Like yesterday, we're recording this session. I'm recording an audio recording on Audacity, and that I'll be saving to my own website and will be posting shortly. Also, we have, as yesterday, a live Illuminate room. Now, it's, as you can see, 4 in the morning where I live, and even earlier in the morning in the rest of North America. And so we have 3 people in the Illuminate room. So I guess, George, you win that contest. George got, how many did you get? About 10 or so people in the Illuminate room. But we do have people in the Illuminate room, and so we are also recording and, as you can see, broadcasting video live. So what I want to talk about today, and I'll talk briefly, is, as you can see from the title, the role of open educational resources and personal learning. I have a few things on the go for this talk, and I'm trying to react in large part to a lot of the discussion that we had yesterday. And there are different layers and different issues of this topic that I want to address. The short version, the really short one slide version of the role of open educational resources in personal learning is that open educational resources are the words that people use in a dialogue or conversation that constitutes personal learning. That's the short version. The rest of the talk will be a bit more, a longer version of that. But I want to begin with a bit of what might be called a meta discussion. And the meta discussion was raised a little bit yesterday, and it is raised almost any time people talk about open educational resources, or that is to say, learning resources that are produced to provide access to learning materials for free for people. And that's the conundrum of open educational resources, having to do with who produces them and who uses them. And Joel Greenberg yesterday talked about people are taking this stuff, but what they're not doing is giving back. We also hear a lot of discussion, and David Wiley has become fond of making this point, that we produce hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of these open educational resources, but there is very little reuse. There's very little sharing. And so it raises the question of the sustainability. It raises the question of, indeed, the sense of the whole enterprise. Why would we even bother doing this in the first place? It doesn't make sense to produce resources that nobody uses, right? So that's the background and the context that I want to be thinking of as I say, as a meta message. It's not the topic of the conversation that we're having here today, but it's a theme that lies in the background. So, what I want to do is focus on the idea of personal learning. Now, people can define personal learning in different ways, and I'm not really a definition person, but for the perspective or for the purposes of this discussion, we'll think of personal learning thought of as learning from the perspective of the learner, not from the perspective of the institution. So I'm not interested in programs and courses and degrees and certification or even assessment. And we can talk about those in the discussion if you want, but that is not the focus of this talk. Nor is it from the perspective of the content to be taught, the subject matter, the facts and propositions and rules and principles that make up what we typically consider to be the content or the subject matter. So what I want to say when I'm talking about personal learning is that the product of personal learning is not learning, properly so called. The product is the learner, him or herself. The product, the outcome, the desired end state is some form of individual growth, individual development. And I mean that in a very literal sense. I mean that in the sense that we expect, we want, we desire actual physical changes to have taken place in the learner. And these physical changes are the outcome of our learning. Now you can think of it by analogy. Think of it by analogy with physical training, right? And the objective of the physical training isn't to lift the weight or to run the distance or anything like that. Those things are not the content of physical training. What we want in physical training is an actual physical change in the body to produce muscles or perhaps skills or abilities, the ability to throw a dart, the ability to hit a ball, whatever. But some actual physical constitution, that is the result. Now, usually we talk about learning in terms of skills or capacities, but I prefer in this context, and in the context of knowledge and learning generally, to talk about it being more like literacy, more like a capacity to work in, to listen, to converse, to dialogue in a language. Now, personal learning, thought of this way and thought of technologically, is best thought of as an ecology in which this learning, in which this growth and development takes place. We typically represent it, and we've seen a few pictures of this already, and I don't have a picture because I didn't have internet access, but we think of it as the learner at the center and then all of the resources scattered around the learner, right? And you've seen probably that famous diagram from Scott Wilson with future VLE in the center and then 43 things and live journal and all the other Twitter and Skype, etc. surrounding. And that is the picture, but drawing that out more widely, we should think of that picture as being one extract or one bit of a mesh. It's one instance or one fragment of a wider mesh. If you think of me as a personal learner surrounded by things, and you as a personal learner surrounded by things, and another person as a personal learner, all of us together form this mesh network, this thick web of connections to each other and to various resources. And that is the ecology or the environment in which personal learning takes place. And that leads us to our first description of connective knowledge. And connectivism, of course, is a theory of learning, a theory of learning design, a theory of pedagogy that George Siemens and I and various other people have messed around with over the years and talked about and disagreed about and agreed about and so on. The most common way, this first way of representing connective knowledge is to say that knowledge, connective knowledge, is the knowledge that is created and shared by an interconnecting community of learners. This is the idea, you know, when people say, I store my knowledge in my friends and things like that. This is that idea. This is the knowledge of a society, the knowledge of a community of people. This knowledge is created by the people in that community communicating back and forth. Each person in that community possesses a bit of that knowledge, and therefore we say that the knowledge possessed by the community is distributed. It's not all in one person. There's a little bit here, there's a little bit here, there's a little bit here, and so on. And as I say, it's created by conversation and interaction. I'm going to want to talk a little bit more about that. The role of the learner in this kind of ecology, and I'll add, because I don't have a separate slide that says the role of the teacher, because I'm talking about personal learning, non-institutional, etc. The role of the teacher is basically the same as the role of the learner. And the role of the learner in this community is to participate and engage in that community. And the participation and engagement in this community is, at least according to the model of connectivism, guided by personal interest and motivation. It's free form. It's open. I've got the, not staged, akin to Latin. I've misspelled his name. I always do that. I want it to be Wegner, and it's not. It's Wenger or Wenger. Anyhow, what I want to say, it just bugs me. Hang on. Editing on the fly. Thank you. I want to say, there's this model of interaction and participation and community where, you begin as the novice and you're on the outside, and then progressively you move more toward the center and more engaged, and you begin by listening and watching, and then that's not really how it works, and it's not, I argue, how it should work. If you look at these communities, you look at any of these communities of practice, quote unquote, you find that the rank beginners don't just sit there and watch things. They jump in and try things, and that's what they should do. And they should do it because they don't even, in my opinion, understand the relevance of what is said or inferred or suggested or done by the expert until they've tried it their own way and begin to see the relevance of that. It's kind of like playing darts. I play darts a lot. And you don't learn to play darts by watching darts on TV. You just don't. And in fact, nobody does. You don't actually watch darts on TV. Well, most people don't watch it at all, right? That's why it's hardly ever on. But you don't watch darts on TV until you've started playing darts. And once you've started playing darts, then you realize the sort of things that you're looking for when you're watching darts. So you don't participate in these communities very gradually from the outside. You jump in full feet first, and make a big splash, and then you discover why that was wrong. Anyhow, I could go on about this, but mainly what I want to say here is that the role of the learner is to participate and engage in this community, to jump in. There's no rules, there's no best way of doing it. Really, it's going to vary according to the individual. There's nothing wrong with being a lurker. There's nothing good about being a lurker. It's different people, different circumstances, different needs. So, a good example of such a learning network is the connectivism course that George Siemens and I set up. We set it up in 2008, and we had 2,200 people sign up. We thought that was pretty good. And we ran it again, and we have about 720 people signed up, and we still think that's pretty good. And George described it a bit yesterday, and again, in the Connectivism course, as with these learning networks in general, there's no right way to interact. There's no set of processes that you really must do. There's no specific tool that you must use. And when it comes to the content of the course, and George mentioned this yesterday, there's no set body of content either that you're expected to assimilate or to remember. And in fact, we say very clearly, and then we start dumping content on people to make the point, that you will not be able to even read all of the content in the course, much less remember it. We don't want you to remember content. What we want you to do is swim in this content as though it were an ocean and learn to work with this environment. The content isn't the point of the course. The content is just the environment in which the course takes place. So the Connectivist course that we talked about is an example of open sharing, and it is an example of one of these mesh networks that I was talking about. So each one of these little dots might be the locus of some individual creating some content somewhere. And there's no linear structure, there's no linear order, there's no place to begin or end. You know, George put in the wiki week one, week two, week three, and that looks like an order, but you know, actually I don't think even we've followed that very well, have we, George? It becomes no more than a suggestion. We, as instructors in this course, quote unquote, actually we get more benefit than anyone from the course, because we just sort of jump into this course and do what all the learners do, is jump in, start talking, interacting, doing things like this talk or his talk, conferencing, and doing it in an open, sharing way so that other people can see what we're doing and other people can jump in and try for themselves. And that's exactly what they do. The question is, and this came up yesterday, why do it this way? I mean, why not just talk in front of a room like this, like we're doing now? What pedagogical purpose is served by open sharing as opposed to publishing a book, producing a video, or whatever? And the answer I am going to argue here, and this is the core or the essence, if you will, of my talk, lies in the nature of knowledge and learning itself. I want you to think, and I'm using the word science here. I don't have to use the word science. I could use the word discipline more broadly. Any area of human endeavor, any subject, I'll say science because in the end they're all kind of like sciences. I guess that's kind of a scientific-centered point of view, but you know what I mean. The traditional view, and again, this could be physics, this could be chemistry, this could be drama, this could be art, whatever, right, is that science and knowledge is a set of propositions, a set of facts and principles that describe the nature of the world. And then learning the science, becoming knowledgeable, becoming expert in this science, would be remembering this body of facts and principles. Now, when we look at scientists themselves, scientists don't actually do this, and you look at scientists, they're some of the most forgetful people on the planet. It's not a coincidence that we have this stereotype of the absent-minded professor. Remembering things really isn't a very good way to go about learning a science. First of all, I don't even have the point on the diet. There's too much to remember. You know, even simple sciences like physics or chemistry, where the body of knowledge is pretty well defined and pretty well known, is almost too overwhelming for any individual to absorb and to learn. But even were it possible for them to do that, the second problem is the facts and the principles of sciences, even the essential sciences, are not static. They're not unchanging. They're constantly changing. You know, things as coarse as, you know, the definition of a planet to our understanding of the fundamental nature of the universe and the rest, these are all changing. If you're in something that isn't as concrete as physics or chemistry, and say sociology or education or any of these other disciplines, economics, knowledge is changing almost day to day, week to week. Alan Greenspan, who governed the United States economic system for I don't know how many years, turns around and says, gee, I guess I was wrong after the economic collapse. Well, if Alan Greenspan overturned his idea of economics as a science in the space of a month, things can change. But even worse, in any discipline, once you get to a certain point of investigation, there ceases to be facts of the matter. The discipline itself resembles more a chaotic system where you cannot actually pin down things like cause and effect principles. It's a lot like predicting the weather. There is no fact of the matter regarding what the weather will be tomorrow, because tomorrow is in the future, right? And no matter how much knowledge of the weather we have, we cannot know that we're right or wrong about the weather until tomorrow comes and it rains or it snows or whatever. Well, probably won't snow, but eh, you never know. Feels like it'll snow. and this tends to be true. It's in environments where you have multiple mutually dependent variables, like in the famous three bodies problem, where these things interact with each other, you're not able to pin down where anything is going to be at any given time. There's another view of science, and this view is actually a bit more current, because, you know, I think people have sort of implicitly agreed with the idea, well, okay, we can't nail it down as a set of facts, doesn't make sense. And it's the view of science as a set of processes or procedures, the scientific method or the practice of being a science. And we see it a lot in other disciplines under the heading of best practices, right? And again, it's the idea here that if we had the method or the rules down, then that would constitute knowledge of this discipline or this subject. However, again, what we see, there's a few things. Oh, and I guess my words went off the bottom of the slide. Oh, well. There's a couple of difficulties. First of all is the danger of emphasizing the process rather than the results. So the science becomes the process itself. And any of you who have written articles for journals will understand what I mean. Where the article has to fit the exact format that the journal decides is good science. There's a tendency on this view even to confuse the metrics of this process, the actual doing of the process, with the doing of science itself. And this is characteristic of the efforts that have been undertaken recently to evaluate academic output in terms of impact factors, number of citations, etc. You could discover the secret of gravity, but if your journal impact factor wasn't high enough, you wouldn't get tenure. Now, there's this confusion of process and result. But even more significantly, and it's a problem parallel to the last problem in the first view of science, there actually isn't a process or mechanism that will describe scientific procedure. Like Paul Feyerabend says in Against Method, there is no method. There is no set of processes that characterizes what an expert would do in a given circumstance. Every circumstance is different, every environment is different, every expert is different, and as a consequence, you can't say, here is a set of rules, this set of rules will define science. It's the problem that artificial intelligence researchers encountered when they tried to build rule-based systems of artificial intelligence. Oh, you're shaking your head. Okay, we'll get to that in the question. But it is the same. See, I am paying attention. It's the same, but it is the same problem. You cannot get at the knowledge of a discipline by a set of rules. You cannot describe the practices of a discipline by a set of rules. The model, I think, is most accurate in describing what science actually is, and therefore what knowledge and a discipline actually is a conversation. And I mean that pretty literally. I said pretty literally because I mean it a little bit metaphorically, but mostly literally. And there are two kinds of conversations that happen. The first conversation, and I really want to think of this as a conversation with a syntax or mechanisms or methods or rules or processes of having the conversation, along with a semantics and a pragmatics and all the rest of the attributes we might think of in a language. So the first one is the conversation scientists have with their body of inquiry. Because it's not simply, you know, you do an experiment, you observe the result, you write something down, that's science. Because that's a very structured, static, one-dimensional kind of science. This kind of science that I'm talking about is where you it's almost like science is play, where you go in and you start messing around with the domain. And in that messing around with the domain, you kind of get an understanding of how that domain works. And it's this kind of getting of this understanding that eventually leads you to come out with some kind of sentence that seems sort of to characterize what it is that you've seen. And I'm being wishy-washy like that very deliberately, because that's the way scientists do it. They kind of get an idea of what they're studying, and then only eventually are they able to articulate that. The second kind of conversation is the conversation that scientists have with each other, because they're messing around with their programs or their experiments or their rockets or whatever it is they're messing around with, and then they talk to each other about it. And, you know, well, my rocket went 200 feet and I put such and such a fin on. I saw rockets on TV this morning, that's why. And they talk to each other about it. And what happens here is the scientist having a conversation with the world has a set of artifacts with which he or she talks to the world, and similarly they have a set of artifacts with which they talk to each other. And this combination too is a mesh, and I've just picked something, don't read too much into that slide. And again, it's this interaction of subject, of scientist, of object, piece of work, essay, experiment, etc., and all the relations and connections drawn between them. As George said yesterday, correctly, even though I kind of called him on it, science is basically a connecting enterprise. Science basically becomes the formation of connections, and the result is this complex web of connections between concepts, artifacts, phenomena, people, theories, and actions. And the way to make this work is to have scientists, the actual people, who are the product. The key to making science work is to create scientists as these connectors. People who are literate in this kind of conversational language. People who are literate in the conversation with the world, who are literate in the conversation with each other. And what that means is very much what it means to be literate in a language, where, you know, again, knowing a language isn't just knowing a set of rules, knowing a language isn't just knowing a set of words and what they mean, but it's actually being able to engage, recognizing patterns, making the right move, as Wittgenstein said, playing the language game in the way that would be expected by the other person you're talking with. This leads to, I'm almost there. This the second type of connective knowledge, the less common way of representing knowledge, and that's personal knowledge. The way a person who is one of these scientists who is literate is constructed. And the way they are constructed is a bad word because it implies that somebody constructed, but is shaped physically. Even shaped is a bad word. I don't mean it in a teleological sense. What I mean here is that this person, this scientist who has the capacity to communicate in this language, has this capacity by virtue of the connections that have been formed, the patterns that have been formed in the neurons in his mind, in his brain. So there's an internal mesh network as well, isn't there? And this mesh network internally creates personal language, creates personal knowledge or personal learning in the same way, through the same processes, that the set of connections between scientists and the world create connective knowledge publicly in a community. And this knowledge is distributed, and this knowledge is ineffable. It cannot be expressed in words. It is the connecting of neurons, and there aren't words inside neurons. They're too small for that. There aren't little pictures of sailboats. There aren't little Facebook pages. All there are neurons doing neuron kind of things and associating and connecting with each other in known ways. And learning, therefore, is the process. It's the set of experiences that generate these patterns in the brain, these patterns of connectivity. So, you know, we had these views of learning, these old views of learning, where learning is the remembering of facts, or learning is a set of processes or skills, but really, learning is the conversation that is taking place inside our head, that is created by the conversation that takes place outside between each other, where the product is not the assimilation of some knowledge, the acquisition of some skills, but the product is the learner, him or herself, the actual set of connections. Now, Papert, when he was talking about constructionism, talked about people constructing artifacts as constructing media with which to think. And this is literally the case. When we create media, when we create blog posts, when we create Facebook pages, any of these things, what we are doing is manipulating words in this language, in this conversation that scientists or learners have with each other. And so the question comes, and it comes around to us full circle, what vocabularies are we using? What languages are we using? Because these vocabularies, these languages, are what define, well, not just science, but are also what define community, what define culture, and in the end, what define ourselves. You know, we ask who owns the conversation. We are asking not simply a question like who owns science, but because of the way these conversations relate to each other, the public conversation and the private conversation, it's a question of who owns ourselves. Who owns the thoughts, the ideas that make us who we are, that make us literate in the way that we are? You know, there's the old way, and Alejandro talked about it yesterday, this idea that, you know, we can just change people by talking to people, change people by telling people things. And that's a model where the knowledge is owned by the institution, the knowledge is owned by the provider. But really, as he says, we need to move from mention to use, where we are not the receivers of this conversation, we are not listeners of this language, we are speakers. Because it's only by speaking the language and working in the language that we become fluent in the language, that we become language. And so our social networks are the mesh in which we practice this language, that we speak in this language, and therefore make the science and the culture our own. Almost there. Really now. This takes us back to the meta message. And the meta message, remember, was a message about who produces open educational resources and who uses open educational resources. And in the end, in the final analysis, we cannot produce knowledge for people, period. The people who are benefiting from these open education resource initiatives are the people who are producing these resources. And it's kind of ironic, the person benefiting the most from this discussion that we're having is me. I'm getting all the results from this because I'm the one who's talking, creating, stimulating, forming connections, and well, it's sort of ironic. You know, and the you know, it's a question that I ask over and over of you know these funding bodies, these foundations, etc. Why are you funding MIT and Stanford and whomever to produce open educational resources when if you want the benefit to be realized by people out there, you would be funding the people out there to produce their own educational resources, to produce their own knowledge. And so my proposition, the meta proposition, is that the only sustainable system of open educational resources will be resources produced by the learners themselves. And that's the end of my meta message. And sorry I went a bit long, but not that long.
No, we're okay.
Yeah, I mean, we're okay.
Right.
So, and that's
no
the
question.
Talk.
So we have a period for question now.
Thanks, Ian. Really interesting presentation. The obvious question, though, is why will it be more compelling for the learners themselves to produce the knowledge and resources to share than it currently is for educators? What's the value proposition for the learner? Why won't the learner just absorb the knowledge, say thank you very much, I understand that, and then move on without sharing?
Well, I mean, the short answer to this, that is, that's not how knowledge is generated. You know, we want people to produce connections in the mind, and you don't produce connections in the mind simply by watching things. You produce connections in the mind by doing things. And it's the doing of something that will generate the knowledge. So if they're just watching, they're not learning. If they're doing, they are learning. And in the short form, that's what the reason is.
Are you saying the conversation, the learning is in the conversation, and as long as you establish learning conversations, then this will just have to evolve organically? In other words, if we're having a discussion
right.
about something, we're having,
yeah.
we're having a learning conversation, we're probably knowledge to each other, so.
Yeah, there's an undertone to your comments. For example, when you say learning organically, that suggests a comparison with an inorganic learning, which suggests a comparison with an outcome-based learning. And so the subtext to what you're asking is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think I'm misreading your questioning here. The subtext to your comment is, how do I get specific learning outcomes if the process is organic or non-directed? So far, so good?
No, not necessarily. All I'm trying to get at is that...
Because why would it matter otherwise? Yeah. Why would you ask the question?
Well, I'm only interested in, you know, how my mind works as a system-type mind. Again, mm-hmm. I'm trying to imagine this as a system where there is some way of representing the knowledge that we're imparting to each other. And how is that process taking place? And where does the knowledge, is the knowledge just in our heads? We're not talking about accreditation here, we're not talking about
right.
more degrees. You know, we're having a conversation, and through that conversation, I learned something.
Right.
You've imparted knowledge to me, job done.
And you're trying to say what it is that you've learned.
Well, yeah, and how are we saying? Yeah. Is that all we're saying? That in itself is good enough? that we're having a learning conversation.
I would make it even a bit stronger. I would say that to actually articulate what it is that you've learned in the form of a sentence or something like that is to misrepresent what it is that you've learned. And this is a key point. And I want to word this carefully because it's partially, well, mostly for my own benefit, but also partially for your benefit. When we're engaged in some kind of learning process, some kind of conversation, remember, I think of conversation very widely. I don't just think of you and me exchanging sentences, right? If we have a fist fight, that's another kind of conversation, a more violent one. If we go dig up the ground, that's a different kind of, so all of these are conversations. Now, when we do these things, we have a wider set of experiences. I'll use the example of talking because it's simple. We're not just exchanging the words. The words are just one aspect of that conversation, but there's all kinds of things happening. The ever so slight nod that you make, the nod of the person in front of you, the person doing the camera there where he's pointing it at some stranger in the back there, whatever. All of these other things are happening as well. All of these things form a part of our experience of this conversation. So if we take a snapshot of something, some bit of learning that happened, that bit of learning that happened is a little bit of the content, a little bit of the context, a little bit of the weather, a little bit of the thing happening over there. It's not a sentence. And so what the impact on our neural net, on our brain, is widespread. It's not localized. It's not a single point of impact. And when we turn around and try to represent that as the learning that such and such, we're misrepresenting it. And importantly misrepresenting it is because it almost as though we've pulled it out and abstracted it and said, this is the thing that we're learning. Is that clear, or does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, there are sort of in the abstract. I mean, how about articulating in something? I need to learn how to take something apart and put it back together again. I'll give you an example. We work with the Ministry of Defence in the UK, and they were using question mark to assess. They're doing a classic summative assessment. Their concern was, which is why they were just in the formative assessments that we were doing, the soldiers knew how to take a rifle apart and put it back together again, but they didn't understand how the rifle worked. So under pressure, it would all collapse because it would break down unless they actually understood. So that's a real practical example. I need to not only learn how to take a rifle apart and put it together again, I need to actually understand how the rifle works. So that is the learning process I'm trying to go through. So I'm just trying to relate an example like that to the sort of things that you're talking about, how that would take place through a learning conversation or...
That's going to take place by shooting rifles. That's going to take place by taking apart and putting together rifles in varying conditions. There is no act of taking apart and putting together a rifle. Right? There's no such thing. There are many acts under different conditions, in mud, in sand, in rain, under fire, in the training room, while practicing with your friends. All of these are different acts that we generalize under the heading taking apart and putting together a rifle. Now, all of these aspects constitute the learning of this. The proposition, you need to learn how the rifle works in order to put it back together again successfully in these different conditions, is a thesis about learning. Okay, it's a theory. It's suggesting that you need some propositional knowledge in order to correctly put a rifle together. It's an untested theory. It's a theory I would argue is false. I would argue that what makes you able to put a rifle together in all of these different conditions is not some kind of cognitive knowledge of how the rifle works, but the practical knowledge of taking the rifle apart and putting it together in enough different situations so that you can achieve a pattern of connectivity in the mind that constitutes what we would call generalized knowledge of how to take a rifle apart and put it together. The addition of the cognitive bit, you need to know such and such, is pure theory, and I would argue not substantiated by the evidence. How's that?
Yeah.
It's tricky coming up with answers to these things. You never know where they're coming from. You know, it's just three or four tries to get at it. Anyhow.
Well, Stephen, I agree with what you say, except for your concept that this is sort of a universal. Because it seems to me that there are many different things that go by the name of learning. So I can learn where the Plaza de Catalunya is, I can learn to speak Spanish, I can learn what time it is, I can learn how to tie my shoes, and these are all kinds of different activities going on. And some of them, I think that, you know, it's not going to be a self-discovery, I want to find out how algebra works, as much as here are the rules. Start here, and then you flip over into self-discovery. But don't you need sort of a map to start?
Well, again, this is a theory that I'm not sure is borne out by the evidence. Couple of things. First of all, you say these are all different kinds of learning. I say, but in every one of these kind of learning, what has happened is you have drawn connections between neurons in your brain. Your brain has assumed a certain form. So the question is, in what sense are these different kinds of learning? Yeah, you can draw these distinctions, but are these distinctions going to help us understand what is happening when we're learning? And it's not clear that they are. They're distinctions of language, they're distinctions of form, they're distinctions of externality. They're not distinctions in what has happened in our head with respect to learning. You know, at the very best you can say, this kind of learning requires this experience, that kind of learning requires that experience, and that is tautologically true. If you're learning different things, you're having different experiences. Now, analyze the different kinds of learning. There's two of them. There's learning how to get to Plaza de Catalunya, and there's learning algebra. Okay, you didn't say what the first one was, but of course, again, you can break it down, right? You can learn it. Learn how to get to the plaza by looking at a map. You can learn how to get to the plaza by having somebody drag you there. You can learn how to get to the plaza by wandering around aimlessly and eventually finding it. All of those are different ways of learning. Is there a best way of learning how to get to the plaza, right? And the answer to that is probably not. Depends on where you are when you're beginning. Depends on what kind of prior learning you've already had. For me, learning how to get to the plaza, I just go there. And once I've gone there, I know. I'll never need to do it again, right? I just know. Other people, they need to go there a few times. They need to have the map with them, so their kind of learning will be different. Other people grew up here, and they don't ever actually need to learn. You know, algebra, learning the rules. Is learning algebra learning the rules? Well, part of the proposition in this presentation was that learning a science, which includes algebra, is not learning rules. And the learning the totality of algebra is not learning a set of rules. You know, and it's the classic sort of problem. It's the kind of problem that people like Kirshner, Sweller, and Clark talk about, where they're talking about these solving problem kind of things, right? And the proposition is, well, if you give people worked examples, then they see how the problem was solved, and then they can solve it for themselves, because according to these people. What you do when you're trying to solve these problems is pick the rule in your mind and apply it to the situation. And if you're shown which rule to pick, then you can spend more of your time learning. But the problem is, when you're working an algebra problem, you're not picking rules. That's not actually how it works. What's happening is, you're looking at a problem and you recognize, as in pattern recognition, as in it snaps into place, you recognize, oh, it's one of these, and then you go about it. I was talking with someone yesterday, I think it might have been Kathleen, but it might not have been, about firemen, firefighters, going into a room, and you know, you go into the room, you start putting out the fire, and the process, the rules are, take the hoses, put them on the fire. Right? That was a scientific. Right. And so they're in there, there's a bunch of them in there, they're putting out the fire, and the fire chief, very experienced expert, says, everybody out, everybody out. And everybody gets out, and then the room blows up. And people ask, well, how did you know? There's no rules. You know, and you can sort of look at it after, and the fireman says, well, we put water on that, and it should have gone out, but it didn't go out. And, you know, it felt warm, and it shouldn't have felt warm like it felt warm. Like, you know, fires always feel warm, but it shouldn't have felt warm like that. So, and then I realized, and it was one of those, right? And what this is, it's not a rule-based kind of thing. It's strictly pattern recognition. It's that situation in front of you caused that pattern of connectivity in your mind to activate. That pattern of connectivity was created in the first place by fighting 1,000 different fires. But there is no set of rules that is the same as that description of that pattern of activity. And in fact, for every firefighter, even if you could reduce it to rules, for every firefighter they'd be different, because they've had different experiences. Chess, same thing. Chess, classic game of rules, right? Move the knight two up, one over. Move the king anyhow. Chess, master chess players don't play by remembering moves. Computers do, but master chess players don't. Again, pattern, situation. They look at the board and they see it's one of those. It snaps into awareness. So you say there's different kinds of learning. I say there's different patterns, but all learning is, in the end, a case of creating patterns that create instances of pattern matching by experts in situations, in environments. Does that make sense?
Well, that makes perfect sense. And, you know, I've read about the firemen as well, but
okay.
I mean,
I only heard about it yesterday, but I've heard similar examples.
I've got one to tell you later on that, but because the type of learning that I work with is quite pragmatic, and we expect behavior change at the end, I think maybe I'm just working with more than learning. Because to solve the types of things we've talked about, it can either be in my head, so I've got my personal neural network, or it can be outside performance support. I can look it up. Somebody can drag me to the plaza. And there's always a trade-off. If I'm thinking ahead on how are people going to get the job done, it's the choice. Well, they can learn, or they can have performance support ready to go and know that it's their call.
Right. That's right. And that's something very different from learning. And I think that's something that we tend to confuse with learning a lot, not just in corporate learning, but in learning in society generally. Because really, from your perspective, right, what you want are performance outcomes, right? Performance improvements, however defined. And it's a little cruel to say it, but strictly speaking, you don't care if the learner actually learned anything as long as you get the performance result, right? So, and yet that is represented as learning, right? It's not learning. It's management. And management is not the same as teaching. You know, you are trying to get specific behaviors out of people, which are defined as improved productivity, da 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 da. You know, and I think in society, in social learning, in you know, our educational system, there's a lot of that as well. People want certain behaviors out of people, right? But that isn't learning. It's behavior modification at best. And it could happen. You could get those outcomes without, in fact, any learning taking place in the individual. So when you ask, how can I get those outcomes, my response is, I don't care. And I really strictly don't care. Why? You know, because my perspective is that of the learner, right? And why should I help? I don't even know how to phrase this, because it gets to the core of things. It's, you know, why should I help managers get more performance out of learners at the expense of learners? You know, it's like,
well, no. I think that's taking it rather far, in that versus, it's not always, you know, managers who are controlling employees or something. I mean, there are a lot of self-directed folks out there, but their motivation is to do things economically and to do things, you know, somewhat efficiently. And they've got to make the choice. Is it performance support or is it learning? So that's why they have to look at that process of learning and say, you know, is this fit? But I'll say that it's semantics for now, because probably other people have questions.
Yeah, there's time for one more question.
It really does bother me, though. Like, for whose benefit is learning? I mean, ultimately, who are the people that we are serving here? I don't know. I don't even want to put it that way, because, you know, ultimately we serve whoever pays us. But you know, who is supposed to get the benefit from learning? And so often it is not the learner. And in any case where it's not the learner, that's where I begin to sort of react that way. Because, you know, if it's not for the benefit of the learner, it's for the benefit of someone else, and often at the expense of the learner. And yeah, sorry, George.
No problem. Just a quick question on one of the things that is starting to define our current era is the prominence of technology, the prominence of devices. And as you hear of progressive integration between the human mind and the devices that we use, and devices that can even just use the software, in a sense, it is learning from our actions and our activity. Not in the truest sense, but in a way, you know, once we've interacted on Google for a while, and, you know, it follows, we've saved our search history or other piece of software, it starts to anticipate what we might be asking about, or it starts to contextualize the kinds of questions. So if it knows that I'm a world traveler, and to use your common example of Paris, yeah, it knows I mean Paris, France, not Plaster of Paris, or it thinks it knows.
Right.
So I'm wondering, in terms of the vision of learning that you put forward, what role do you see increasingly adaptive technology playing as an extended cognitive aid?
That's a good question. To think about that for a second. Everybody wait while I think. Because the first, it's kind of funny, when you talked about adaptive systems, the first thing that sprang to my mind, and this is the way these things work, right, was a baseball glove. Now, we're in Europe, so there's probably not a whole lot of baseball gloves, but let me explain. Baseball glove is a large padded mitten that you wear on one hand that you use to catch baseballs. Okay, baseball is a game played in North America and Japan, and elsewhere, I guess. So, all you need to know is it's a large padded mitten you use to catch a ball. And for a baseball player, it's a very personal thing. You have your own glove. You don't just borrow somebody's glove. Well, you can, but you typically don't. You have your own glove, and they're made out of leather, and anyone who's worn leather shoes knows when you first get the baseball glove, it's all stiff and unyielding, but then as you use it over time, it sort of adapts, right? And, you know, you see, actually, you see baseball players just pounding the ball into the glove, and they're just working the glove, right, so that the glove fits the ball, fits their hand, and the leather just sort of adapts. That's what an adaptive system is. is a baseball glove. It's a computerized baseball glove that works with semantical objects rather than baseballs. But it's the same kind of thing. And so it's a tool that you use to interact with the world. It's a tool that adapts to what you're doing. How does that fit? Well, I still don't know how it fits, but first pass, which is really all I'll get a time for, is it is itself a kind of network. It is itself a kind of thing that learns, that obtains a different structure according to the different inputs and the different outputs, just like a baseball glove. A baseball glove is a network of, I was going to say leather atoms, but there's no such thing. Leather molecules? Is there anyhow, a baseball glove is, a complex webbing of whatever leather is made of. Skin molecules? And the connections between these things adapt as you use it. Same sort of thing. That's the first pass. It's a network that you use because, there are networks all over. There's the social network, there's the mind, but, you can have your own personal network that will learn, that becomes something that you can talk to. So, I don't know. That's the first pass. In a week from now, I might have a different answer to that. But
it's a quick question. We don't have more time yet. It's your turn now. You can speak now. So we're inviting the next two speakers. Okay. So you can talk now.
Okay. Well, I'll turn off all my recorders here. And okay. So.